Today is Thursday, September 30th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Gina Duofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Senate moves to avert a government shutdown.
This is a familiar position that the U.S. government has found itself in recent years, is increasingly leadership on Capitol Hill and the White House.
Plus, Red Cross warns of humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan.
Difficult access to healthcare, particularly in rural areas. Widespread poverty among much of the population. Significant food insecurity among much of the population.
Also, Jordan seeks greater ties with Syria. Our top story today is in the U.S. The Senate is expected to approve legislation Thursday that would keep the federal government running into early December. The House is expected to approve the measure following the Senate vote, preventing a partial government shutdown when the new fiscal year begins Friday. In addition, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warns that if the debt limit isn't raised by October 18th, the country will likely face a financial crisis. Democrats are struggling over how to get President Joe Biden's top domestic priorities over the finish line. Those include a bipartisan infrastructure bill that contains $550 billion in new spending for roads, bridges, broadband, and other priorities, as well as a $3.5 trillion package for social, health, and environment programs. For more on the battles over government funding, I spoke with VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson.
This is a familiar position that the U.S. government has found itself in recent years, as increasingly leadership on Capitol Hill and the White House have found themselves at odds on an agreement over funding levels for the U.S. government. And they face a hard deadline, September 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year for the U.S. government. Now, the original problem in this situation was that Democratic leaders had linked the issue of raising the debt ceiling, the debt that the U.S. government will honor, to the issue of government funding, which Senate Republicans disagreed with. Once they delinked those two issues, then they were able to get what's called a clean CR, a clean continuing resolution, that's just basically saying we are going to fund the U.S. government for the next 2 months while we figure out all of these other issues.
Were there certain trade-offs to get us to this point?
Well, because this is called a clean CR, a clean continuing resolution, that basically means that they're not making any other agreements or negotiations in tandem with this agreement to fund the government for another 2 months. They're basically just saying we can't reach an agreement on anything else, so we're just going to push it down the road for 2 months and give ourselves more time to negotiate.
The Senate is expected to take up a bill from the House if it passes the $3.1 trillion infrastructure bill. What are its chances?
Well, the infrastructure bill is another problem for Democratic congressional leadership because they're facing opposition from within their own party about this bill. Technically, Democrats have control of the U.S. Senate. They have a slim majority in the U.S. House. And of course, they have the control of the White House. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they can pass all the Democratic legislation. Progressives in the U.S. House of Representatives are saying that they will not give their votes to passing this Democratic infrastructure bill unless they get an agreement on a larger social policy bill. They're saying that they want funding for a broad range of programs that would fund early childhood education, child care, health care, and of course, climate change, addressing some of the climate change issues through clean energy jobs. They want a whole broad range of funding that some moderate Democrats are a little bit nervous about bending on. They're going to hammer out this deal supposedly today. That was the deadline set by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, but she's already moving some of the deadline for that, saying that they still need more time to negotiate.
This bill appears to have broad support within the Republicans and the Democrats because it talks about building bridges, repairing infrastructure, health care, and even climate change. So what is the contentious issue and why is this becoming a difficult problem to just get to the finishing point?
Well, it's primarily because what progressives are asking for will be a higher price tag. They want to see more government spending, saying that these are critical issues that the nation needs addressed, that if you fund early childhood education and child care, you get more working mothers back into the economy. They say that climate change is a crucial issue to address, that it can't wait any longer, and that when you fund clean energy jobs, you actually benefit the American economy.
That's VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson speaking with me from Washington. A new national survey conducted by the Eurasian Group Foundation finds that most Americans say they want more diplomacy and fewer U.S. military deployments around the world. The findings come in the first large-scale opinion poll conducted since the end of the 20-year-old U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
With the last U.S. troops leaving Afghanistan in August after 20 years, President Joe Biden told the United Nations that the United States is pivoting from an era of relentless war to an era of relentless diplomacy. A new national survey of 2,000 U.S. voters finds that most Americans appear to agree. A majority of those polled by the Eurasia Group Foundation want to decrease the number of U.S. troops stationed overseas and reduce security commitments abroad, while 58% say they want to increase U.S. diplomatic engagement. Caroline Gray is a lead researcher on the survey.
And we found that 62%, quite a majority, thought that the biggest lessons from the war was that the United States should not be in the business of nation building, or that it should only send troops into harm's way if vital national interests are threatened.
The report notes among younger voters, ages 18 to 29, 80% believe that unless the United States is under attack, the president should be required to seek congressional approval before ordering military action overseas.
65% of younger Americans want to revive nuclear negotiations with Iran. They're more skeptical of America increasing its military presence in East Asia to counter a rising China. And a majority of them also want to scale back U.S. defense spending. So they're a lot more likely than their older counterparts to want to scale back America's military posture and reliance on the military in solving global challenges.
Americans appear divided on the best approach to China and Russia, according to the survey, with 40% saying they are unsure about what the U.S. should do if China were to invade Taiwan. This appears to contrast with what one expert said is the bipartisan consensus among U.S. foreign policy leaders.
I think in the security realm, Washington, D.C., as you well know, is obsessed with China as a rising competitor. The president himself has talked very often about this era that we're moving in, an era of great power competition, an era of democracy versus autocracy. And a real concern that China, as an autocracy that has a lot of resources and a clear plan and intentionality to dominate kind of the global discussion.
The survey found that humanitarian aid, disaster relief, and COVID-19 relief are the most popular types of international assistance, while military assistance and weapons sales are the least popular. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The regional director of the International Federation of the Red Cross says if money isn't restored to pay for wages and services, the coming winter could bring a, quote, major humanitarian crisis, unquote, for Afghanistan. Alexander Mateo says Afghanistan is set to enter a, quote, extremely difficult few months, unquote, as temperatures drop, compounding food shortages resulting from drought and poverty. Speaking at a press conference in Kabul on Thursday, he said that cuts to health services put many vulnerable Afghans, particularly in rural areas, at risk.
The last time I was in Afghanistan was 20 years ago, and many of the issues that I saw then, 2000 and 2001, you would still see today in terms of difficult access to healthcare, particularly in rural areas, widespread poverty amongst much of the population, significant food insecurity amongst much of the population, especially during lean season. The financing of the health system has been cut off. This has resulted in over 2,500 health facilities no longer working, over 20,000 health staff no longer being employed, no longer being paid, many of which are not working, over 7,000 of which are women. The consequences of that on access to healthcare, particularly primary healthcare, maternal child healthcare, is significant.
That's Alexander Mateo, Asian Pacific Director for International Federation of the Red Cross. China is the world's largest seafood consumer, and its fleet often fishes waters claimed by South Korea. When South Korean authorities try to enforce international regulations, they often meet fierce resistance. Seong-Yuk Park filed this report with information provided by Youngjin Kim in Seoul.
South Korean fishermen have seen this too often. An old boat near the inter-Korean maritime border steams across the Yellow Sea and heads towards South Korea's territorial waters, also known as the West Sea, to fish.
There are so many Chinese fishing ships crowding near the island. I make a point not going to the other side of the island. I don't just want to see them. There are so many.
South Korean fishermen say the Chinese fleet ignores international norms by overfishing and even taking egg-bearing females.
Chinese fishermen snatch up all living things. We release the ones that fall outside legal sides. But they take everything because they are operating in someone else's waters. They take every moving organism, every form of marine life.
The Chinese boats fish near the maritime boundary between South and North Korea. They know South Korean authorities can't cross that line. But the chase can turn dangerous.
It's difficult to regulate them. Chinese fishermen exercise brute force, such as hanging metal booms on their ships or using deadly weapons to keep South Korean Coast Guard officials from boarding.
VOA's Korean service contacted the Chinese embassy in South Korea for official comment, but received no response. In the last 10 years, South Korean authorities have caught almost 4,000 Chinese ships fishing illegally. Many more evaded capture.
Through the cooperation between the governments of South Korea and China, the cases of illegal fishing decreased since 2015. But since last year, China's illegal fishing significantly increased as monitoring was sidelined because of COVID-19 prevention measures.
Tracking the Chinese fishing vessels is difficult. Many are unregistered in China.
The majority of Chinese fishing fleets operating illegally in South Korean waters cannot operate within Chinese waters. Either they don't have a permit from the Chinese government or they are unregistered vessels that stole the registration numbers of the other Chinese vessels.
As officials from the two nations search for solutions, South Korean fishermen see little progress.
When South Korean fishing ships approach the South Korean maritime boundary or go beyond it, there is a big fuzz. But when Chinese fishing boats move about freely near the border, it drives us crazy.
As the game of cat and mouse continues, Seung-Hyuk Park for VOA News, Washington.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says he's willing to restore severed inter-Korean hotlines next month, but accused the United States of proposing talks without changing its, quote, hostile policy, unquote, to the country, state media KCNA reported on Thursday. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says he's willing to restore inter-Korean hotlines next month, in a quote carried by state media KCNA on Thursday. But he also slammed the United States for proposing talks without changing its, quote, hostile policy towards the country. North Korea severed the hotlines in early August in protest against joint South Korea-U.S. military drills, just days after reopening them for the first time in a year. According to KCNA, Kim said reactivating the lines would help, quote, realize the expectations and desire of the entire Korean nation for recovering cross-border relations, adding that we have neither aim nor reason to provoke South Korea and no idea to harm it. Meanwhile, Kim had tougher words for Washington, writing, quote, the U.S. is touting diplomatic engagement and dialogue without preconditions, but it is no more than a petty trick for deceiving the international community and hiding its hostile acts. South Korea's unification ministry welcomed Kim's offer on the hotlines, but did not comment on his other remarks. The U.S. has said it reached out to North Korea to break an impasse over talks aimed at dismantling its nuclear weapons program in exchange for relief from U.S. sanctions. Earlier this week, North Korea fired a previously unseen hypersonic missile, rattling the U.S. and its southern neighbor. Pyongyang again said it urged Seoul and Washington to drop their, quote, double standards on weapons development. Diplomats say Western powers have requested a closed-door U.N. Security Council meeting on Thursday to discuss Pyongyang's latest test.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. French ex-president Nicolas Sarkozy has been convicted and sentenced to a year of house arrest for illegal campaign financing in his unsuccessful 2012 re-election bid. The court said Thursday it would allow him to serve the sentence at home by wearing an electronic monitoring bracelet. Sarkozy has vigorously denied wrongdoing. He can appeal the decision, which would suspend the sentence. Ecuador's president has declared a state of emergency in the prison system following a battle among gang members killed at least 116 people and injured 80 in a coastal lockup. Authorities said it was the worst prison bloodbath ever in the country. Officials say at least five of the dead were found to have been beheaded. The state of emergency that President Guillermo Lasso declared on Wednesday gives the government powers that include deploying police and soldiers inside prisons. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Tight global energy supplies pushed oil prices above $80 a barrel for the first time in 3 years on Tuesday, before retreating in a broader sell-off in the financial markets. Demand rose due to easing lockdown measures and wider rollouts of COVID-19 vaccinations, analysts say, as well as disruptions in supply due to hurricanes in the United States. Will OPEC and other exporting countries increase supplies? For VOA, Dave Gablack reports from Amman.
Goldman Sachs expects oil prices for benchmark Brent crude to hit $90 per barrel by the end of the year as supply tightens. The recovery from the impact of the Delta variant of the coronavirus was faster than expected, especially with international travel, it said, while Hurricane Ida hit U.S. production. Although some analysts find that the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries and their allies known as OPEC Plus have been slow to raise their oil output to address the shortfalls, others like Carol Nehla, CEO of Crystal Energy in London, told VOA that there is no real oil supply shortage.
I struggle to see how we can have a shortage of supply when you have OPEC Plus sitting on several millions of barrels a day of spare capacity. So usually, if you look historically, when we had serious crises in oil markets and prices going significantly high, that spare capacity was very low. Today, that is not the case. So we have voluntary decision not to put all that oil in the market, and that's contributing to the current tightness. Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Kuwait don't seem to be facing any problem. If they want, they can easily appease the pressure in the market.
Neil Quilliam, an associate fellow at London's Chatham House, told VOA that it is hard to say whether OPEC, which meets next week, will increase production. But he notes that U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman earlier this week.
But I would find it really hard to imagine that, you know, given where the price of oil is at the moment and given that OPEC's meeting next week, that that didn't form an important part of that conversation. I mean, it's hard to say, but the signals so far are they're going to stick on to where production currently is, and they're going to keep in alignment with plans to increase production by 400,000 barrels each month until the end of the year.
Norbert Rücker of the Swiss private bank Julius Baer said that the deficit in world gas supplies is driving the global energy crunch. He told the Wall Street Journal that this is now spilling over into the oil market because of the expectation that this energy scarcity means we're going to use oil for spillover demand. Oil can be used in some power plants to generate electricity when gas prices surge. Nehle says gas markets have no such OPEC Plus entity. Currently, Russia is seen to be restricting some of its supplies to Europe to gain more support for its Nord Stream 2 pipeline and to take advantage of higher prices. But Russia does not have the same impact on gas prices as you have, for example, with OPEC 2 in oil markets, she says. Gas prices have risen in part due to a worldwide production deficit, depleted inventories, as well as China turning to gas from coal. Analysts say the energy crisis will worsen if there is a very cold winter ahead in the northern hemisphere. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
Jordan reopened its main border crossing with Syria Wednesday in what appears to be a push to reintegrate Damascus into regional political and economic structures. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Jordan and Syria officially reopened the main Jabir Nassib border crossing between the two countries Wednesday after an apparent U.S. green light to jumpstart regional trade and economic dealings. Egypt recently agreed to sell gas to Lebanon via both Jordan and Syria. Qatar's Al Jazeera TV reported that a decision to resume flights between the Jordanian capital Amman and the Syrian capital Damascus was canceled due to opposition from Washington. Both the Syrian and Jordanian military chiefs met recently in Damascus to work out the final details of the reopening of the key border link between the two countries. Jordan has reportedly lost around $20 billion in trade over the last 10 years due to closures of its border with Syria and the disruption of regional trade routes between Turkey and Lebanon to the Gulf states via Syria and Jordan. Colonel Ahmed Karan, a top Jordanian customs official at the Jabir Nassib border crossing, told Arab media that traffic between Syria and Jordan has been on the medium side, but that he expects trade traffic to pick up in the coming days. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA that the decision to reopen the border crossing between Jordan and Syria is a pragmatic move that follows the realization that the Syrian opposition is not going to win the conflict against the government in Damascus, and ties between Damascus and its Arab neighbors need to resume.
Now there is realization that Assad and the Russian had won. Opposition had been defeated. America is withdrawing from the area, and there was also this ban of sending gas from Egypt to Jordan to Syria to Lebanon.
Sadiq adds that a number of Arab foreign ministers, including those of Egypt and Jordan, met with Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal al-Mikdad on the sidelines of the just-ended UN General Assembly annual session, indicating that there is something in the air regarding normalizing ties with Syria. He thinks that will benefit the Syrian economy, people, and the entire region, reducing tensions. Paul Sullivan, a Washington-based Middle East analyst, tells VOA that the border between Syria and Jordan has a difficult history in addition to present-day tensions. He thinks it will not be easy to normalize relations with the Assad regime on part of the border while still having to deal with a myriad of dissenting groups within Syria and outside of Syria. Sullivan suggests that the border may again be closed at some point in the future due to tensions over a variety of issues, and he thinks Jordan would be wise to beef up security along the border. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
COVID-19 infections has hit a new record in the Australian state of Victoria. Authorities blame rule breakers for the latest surge in cases. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
More than 1,400 new daily locally acquired cases of COVID-19 were reported in Victoria Thursday. Five more people have died. The numbers have soared, despite some of Australia's strictest stay-at-home orders. Melbourne, the Victorian state capital, has become the third most locked-down city in the world, according to the city's mayor. Residents have endured more than 235 days of lockdown since the pandemic began. Household visits are banned. Victorian authorities have said illegal gatherings and house parties over a public holiday long weekend were behind the sharp rise in COVID-19 infections in the state. Officials also said many people had ignored lockdown directives to be with friends and family, to watch the Australian Rules Football League Grand Final on television, one of the country's most popular sporting events. Victoria Premier Daniel Andrews says when rules are broken, infections increase. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A court in Germany on Thursday said 96-year-old former Nazi concentration camp secretary who fled hours before the opening of her trial has been found. The court in the northern town Isoe has issued an arrest warrant for Imgard Fortuner, one of the first women to be prosecuted for Nazi-era crimes in decades, after she failed to show up at the trial. A court official said Furchner had left retirement home near Hamburg and taken a taxi to a subway station. The suspect is charged with complicity in the murders of more than 10,000 people at the Chuhov concentration camp in Poland during World War II. The court has suspended the hearing in her case until October 19th and now will decide if Furchner will be held in custody. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofori in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. and have a splendid evening.